Omaha Public Radio presents another lecture program from Bellevue University on Noon Forum. This coming Wednesday, December 7th, marks the 65th anniversary of the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor, which led to the United States' entry into World War II. On February 19, 1942, President Roosevelt signed Executive Order 9066, which gave the military broad powers to ban any citizen from a 50 to 60-mile wide coastal area, stretching from Washington State to California and extending inland into southern Arizona. The order also authorized transporting these citizens to assembly centers hastily set up and governed by the military in California, Arizona, Washington State, and Oregon. Although it is not well known, the same executive order and other wartime orders and restrictions were also applied to smaller numbers of residents of the United States who were of Italian or German descent. For example, 3,200 resident aliens of Italian background were arrested, and more than 300 of them were interned. About 11,000 German residents, including some naturalized citizens, were arrested, and more than 5,000 were interned. Yet, while these individuals and others from those groups suffered grievous violations of their civil liberties, the wartime measures applied to Japanese Americans were worse and more sweeping, uprooting entire communities and targeting citizens as well as resident aliens. On today's program, we'll hear a talk by Tom Mia, a Japanese American who was living in California at the time of the Pearl Harbor attack. Mr. Mia, now a longtime resident of Nebraska, will share with us his thoughts and memories of that uncertain time. This program, presented as a celebration of Constitution Day, was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Thursday afternoon, September 15, 2016, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of Bellevue University, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the program is Rick Galusha, Associate Professor in the College of Arts and Sciences at Bellevue University.
229 years ago, on September 17, 1787, the framers of this nation founded a representative republic based upon democratic principles. Despite the many challenges that our nation has faced over that period, the Constitution continues to be the supreme law of the land and the embodiment of our inalienable rights. As a free nation throughout our history, we have felt a tension between the vigilance of protecting our rights and a desire to feel safe. One might think that this is more true today than at previous time in our nation's history. By examining the darker moments of our nation's history, we are able to help ourselves and future generations not make those same mistakes. It does perhaps speak to the strength of our nation and on the authority of the consent of the governed to speak openly and critically of our nation's government and of our national history. Students of the Kirkpatrick Signature Series are taught that objective dissent is among the highest values of loyalty, responsibility of the patriotic citizen. In the Declaration of Independence, Thomas Jefferson tells us it is our duty. On December 7th of 1941, the United States actively entered World War II. By February 19th of 1942, President Franklin Roosevelt signed Executive Order 9066, which resulted in the relocation of American citizens of Japanese descent being sent to confinement camps in California, Wyoming, Idaho, Colorado, Arizona, Utah, and Arkansas. On March 9th of 1942, after less than 90 minutes total of debate in the House and the Senate, the order was upheld by our legislative branches. This action resulted in approximately 120,000 American residents, including 70,000 U.S. citizens, having their constitutional rights being negated. FDR suspended the writ in 1944, and by 1946, the camps were shut down. Today, we can visit these camps like Heart Mountain, just outside of Yellowstone National Park, to learn more, as my family did this summer. Our speaker today, Dr. Tom Mia, who is 93 years young and a resident of Omaha, will speak to us about his memories of these times. After his presentation, we'll have time for some questions. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Mia.
Thank you very much, Rick. It's good to be here this afternoon to talk with some people just about my age. Rick, I have a tendency to sort of ramble and go on and on, so when the time comes up, just speak up and I'll round it up. Well, my parents came from Japan, and just at the turn of the century, early in about 1905 and 1906, at the time he immigrated, he wanted to become a naturalized citizen. But before he could actually get to that point, there was an Asian Exclusion Act that kept them from becoming naturalized, and later on they cut the immigration from the Asia into the U.S. for a number of years. But anyway, following that Exclusion Act, there were piggyback legislation in California that kept my father from purchasing land or even renting a farmland for more than 3 years. But I think he was the one that sort of invented the art of the deal. And he made a deal with a landlord that had 80 acres of very productive land. And although he wasn't supposed to be there for more than 3 years at a time, he worked that farm for over 25 years. And he did very, very well. Even during the Depression, he did very well, even loaning money. And some of you will remember the Depression. Everything was pretty bad. But even in those days, he loaned a friend of his $6,000, which was lots of money during the Depression years. But anyway, I come from a family of seven kids, five boys and two girls. All but one of us went to college, and some of that during the Depression. So that gives you some idea how well he did. But anyway, I went to a two-room elementary school from two rooms. There's four grades in each room. And we only had, my class was only about nine students. But I remember we started out the morning with the Pledge of Allegiance to the flag. And most of you will remember that today when we pledge allegiance, we just put our hand over our heart and we pledge allegiance. But I remember all through those eighth grade, we pledged allegiance to the flag. And we stretched our arm out toward the flag, if you already remember that. And I'm also old enough to remember that when we sang the national anthem, it was not the Star Spangled Banner. All of you still remember that? What was that national anthem then? My Country 'Tis of Thee. Yeah. And until about my third or fourth grade, then we switched to Star Spangled Banner. But anyway, I finished grade school. We didn't have any buses in those days. We walked. It wasn't uphill both ways, but it was a mile away. Then I went off to a consolidated high school with a class of 200 in the class. So it was quite a shock to go from class of nine to class of 200. And I tell you this story to give you some background of how I felt when the evacuation orders came out. Because when I was a junior, my English teacher encouraged me to enter an essay contest. It was a statewide essay contest on the value of American citizenship. And I thought I wrote a pretty good essay. But no, I did not win first, second, or third prize, but I did get a nice commendation certificate congratulating me for entering that contest. And then my senior year, I didn't think I was that good a student, but I found out that I was second in the class. And I was beaten out by, you guessed it, a young lady. That always happens. But anyway, I had to prepare a talk for our graduation. And my graduation talk was titled Youth and National Defense, in which this was in June of 41. Well, we're getting pretty close to Pearl Harbor. So my point was that 2 points. One, and I'm not a psychic, but my plea was that we needed to strengthen our Navy was number one. And number two, the fact that the youth were ready to fight for our country, because you remember in 41, war was already raging in Europe, where Hitler was running wild, and we were reluctant to get into the fray. Well, after I finished my high school, went off to Cal Berkeley. That's the big school. And the semester was almost at its end. Couple of weeks till the end of the semester, then Pearl Harbor struck. And things changed almost immediately, topsy-turvy. And if you know the strength of the media, you know it well today, but in those days, the media was the newspaper. There was no television, radios were very scarce, so the powerful newspaper in California was the Hearst chain. If you remember Patty Hearst and that family. And they were very, very anti-Asian. They cooked up stories that you wouldn't believe, that I couldn't even repeat here. But on top of that, the general, the Army general in command of that western area was a fellow by the name of DeWitt, General DeWitt. And he was also anti-racist. So between the newspaper and that, the things just boiled over in California. And all kinds of things appeared. For example, some of you may have heard of the Battle of Los Angeles. Someone said they saw a Japanese Zero flying over Los Angeles, and the anti-aircraft guns were going off and everything, and they sent chaser planes out because the planes must have come from a Japanese carrier. Well, they sent chaser planes out, and they went way out over the Pacific, like 600 miles, you couldn't see a thing. And then later on, it was discovered that the only thing that was up in air at that particular time was a red air balloon. I mean, a weather balloon that was up in the air. And that's called the Battle of Los Angeles. Then there were other stories about farmers planting their crops with a point that pointed right at the Los Angeles National Airport, International Airport. Well, they later found that that's the way the land was platted. But those are the kind of stories that went around. But then the story started about, well, they're going to get all these people of Japanese descent sent back Now, I don't know about sending back, because some of us hadn't been to Japan. But then that was reduced to we'll have to take these people in California and move them out where they can't do any harm. And my father kept on saying, says, you know, they might take mom and dad, but you guys are American citizens. So they'll never take you. And he held that thought until the very day we left. He said, it's not going to happen. Even after the signs were posted, when the executive order 9066 came out on February the 19th, he still didn't believe it. But anyway, it did happen. And then right after that happened, the FBI came through our little town and snatched up two influential people that could do the organizing and so forth. And you know who they were? One was the local pool hall operator, and the other one was the town cobbler. Yes, we used to repair shoes in those days, if you remember. So to this day, I don't know where they were taken. They were taken somewhere. But anyway, the people in the Japanese in California were kind of evacuated by districts. And we didn't know when our call was coming up. So we were on needles until one day the order came out, and we had about a week and a half to prepare. And they said, the only thing you can take is what you can carry. So that meant, you know, at least maybe two bags and so forth. But anyway, I remember going to the location where the bus was to take us. And they were only going to take us about 20 miles down the road to the Fresno Fairgrounds. And as we were all assembled, there were about three kids in their Eagle Scout uniforms. There was one fellow that fought in the U.S. Army in World War I. And as a sort of a defiance, I guess, he wore his World War I uniform, and he was still trim enough that it fit him just right. And those memories, I remember as it was yesterday. But anyway, we loaded. Well, before that, they passed out little tags with a little string attached to them with a number. Each family had a number. They all had the same number. So there were all of my siblings, and my mother and dad had to tie that little thing with this little string, and I can't recall what our number was. But anyway, we rolled on into the Fresno Assembly Center, and that was supposed to be just a temporary holding pen, if you want to call it. But as we rolled into it, and there were armed guards at the head gate, we passed through that, and pretty soon I saw an enclosure with barbed wire around it, with a big watchtower, with armed guards up there. And I thought, gee, this is an assembly center. Well, I call this the assembly center right here. But they call these places by all kinds of euphemisms. And this is called the assembly center. Well, the first thing as we unloaded from the bus, the guard says, All right? Each one of you will get a canvas bag. It was a mattress cover. And right over there is a stack of straw. Now you are to go over there and fill your canvas bags. That is going to be your mattress. All right? And my mother was a very strong person. But the only time I think she came close to crying because I was right next to her stuffing my bag. And I can see a little glint coming into her eye. But she never did drop a tear. But anyway, then we were escorted to wherever assigned birth we were. And all of our family was put into a open space, I'd say about 20 by 20 feet, just completely empty. There's no running water there, and just beds, single beds, that we plunked our mattress on for the night. The bathrooms were all communal. You'd have to go and use a big communal bathroom. Showers and all that were also separate. And, of course, you know, after going through high school and taking gym and into athletics and so forth, I was kind of used to, you know, communal showers and so forth. But many of them were not. So that was a real hardship on a lot of the older folks. And then we had mess halls. I don't know how many mess halls we had. There were about 5,000 in that original center. But I was amazed how quickly those people within the compound organized everything. Because before you knew it, there were three hospital clinics. Because after all, they were transporting some very sick people into that compound. And one of the first things I did was I volunteered to be an orderly in one of the hospitals. And by volunteering, I got the great sum of $8 a month for being an orderly in a hospital. But they gave me a white coat and a mask, and one of my duties, the particular clinic I was assigned to, happened to be a tubercular clinic. And one of my jobs was to pick up sputum bags, collect them, and dispose of them. And no, I did not get tuberculosis from that. But I remember sputums that were red. But anyway, but we had some very, very fine doctors. And one doctor that was head of the clinic that I was in was a Dr. Hashiba, who was a neurosurgeon, very well-known neurosurgeon. As a matter of fact, when he was needed back in the city of Fresno, they would take him under guard to do his surgery and then bring him back. But anyway, that kind of living sort of destroyed the family unity in the system, because the young kids scattered all over, and they found ways to sneak into mess halls that they shouldn't be in and eat two or three meals for lunch and things like that. But anyway, one of the things that still sticks in my craw, even to this day, was we were given two sheets of paper with questions on them. They called it the loyalty questionnaire. There was one question in there that still bothers me to this day. And you had to answer yes or no. And you couldn't explain why you would answer yes or no. And the question was, do you now disavow all allegiance to the Emperor of Japan? If I had my own way of doing it, I would have answered no. Because if I answered yes, that meant that I previously had an allegiance to the emperor. See? So then the grapevine started, and they said, you know, if you answered no to that question, they're going to send you off to a different, more harsher camp. And that's what actually happened. Those who answered no were sent off somewhere else. So that still sticks in my craw. I can't talk about it without getting a little emotional about the whole thing. But anyway, my first priority was to get the heck out of there, because they were a group of people started by Dr. Nason, who was president of Swarthmore College, called a Student Relocation Committee. And he said, it's a shame that those who were already started on their college curriculum can't get into another university to continue their studies. But anyway, through that, I got a bunch of addresses, particularly in the Midwest, including Nebraska, and all the others, which is now the Big Ten. And I wrote letters, probably a dozen of them. And I kept on getting refusal letters. Most of them said, we have a very large and strong presence of ROTC on the campus, so we don't think it's wise to take people of Japanese ancestry. Some of the letters I got back, I'm still amazed and sort of shocked that people in that capacity and a major university will write letters like, for example, we are not taking Japs at this time. Very blunt. All right? But I got refused by almost all the universities, and I had one more response that I was waiting for. That was Nebraska. And they said, come on, we'll take you. So I was the only one that left that assembly center back of a 10-ton truck with guards that took me to the train station and watched until I got on. And they waved goodbye, and that was the last I saw of that group. But anyway, after about 3 days, because we had to be sidetracked quite often because of the military trains were crisscrossing the nation, and I arrived at, those of you who know where the Haymarket Park is, there's a Burlington, part of the Burlington station is still there. That's where I got off the plane, the train. And the first thing I did was the next day is to go to the registrar's office, because I was late already to start the semester. And the head registrar registered me, and he says, Tom, says, we have a strong, very strong ROTC program at the University of Nebraska. And I I've taken the privilege of putting you down for the class already, if that's all right with you. I said, certainly. He says, all right, now take this slip and go to the armory, get your physical, get your uniform, and because the classes meet tomorrow. So there I was. So I owe a tremendous amount to this state and to the university. And the University of Nebraska ended up taking more Japanese students than any 10 other universities combined. I think there were a total of about 100 of us that were scattered all over. And the reason why that happened was there were three key people at the university. One was a chancellor. One was a registrar who registered me. And the third was Pastor Bob Drew of the Wesley Foundation. And they, before they accepted the first student, they went around, they met with every department head, every school. They met with the police department, the fire department, the city council. They even knocked on doors to see how we would be accepted. And it was almost unanimous among those they met. So that's how I got to Nebraska. And there I met a professor that befriended me, and he became my mentor for really the rest of my career, and even after my career, so until he passed away at 94. But even when I was in the service, he would write me and tell me what was happening. But then I was rolling along. I was 2 weeks into my last semester to get my bachelor's degree. Now, guess what happened? I get a notice from the draft board. So off I went. And eventually I ended up at basic training in Camp Robinson, Arkansas, which is Little Rock, Arkansas, which is only about 100 miles from my parents were incarcerated. But anyway, to make a long story short, my basic training ended, and we were on the parade grounds waiting for orders of deployment by companies and so forth. I was in Company C. Then all of a sudden, things seemed to sort of got quiet because there was a sergeant sort of coming towards the parade ground, and he stopped in the middle of our company and he says, "Mia, T, fall out and follow me." So out of I don't know how many thousand troops out there, they call me out and he says, "Follow me." So I didn't know what was going on. Then when I got to the reporting office, they said, "Soldier, you're not being deployed anywhere. We're going to send you for additional training." So I said, "Where am I going?" He said, "You're going to Camp Ritchie." I said, "Where in the heck is that? Very few people know where Camp Ritchie is." And they shouldn't, because Camp Ritchie was a counterintelligence center just outside of Washington, D.C. That's where they sent me for 3 additional months of training. And I was wondering what they were going to do with me then. You know, whether they were going to send me on a clandestine mission somewhere or what. But again, at the last minute, after we graduated from that intensive counterintelligence training, they said, "Soldier, we're sending you to Fort Meade, Maryland, to the Provost Marshal General's office. And they'll tell you what you're supposed to be doing there." Well, I reported there the next day because Fort Meade was just a short drive from Camp Ritchie. And there, they explained to me what they were doing, and they said, "You are going to be the chief of the classified message center at Fort Meade, Maryland." And he said, "You'll have some guys working with you." And so I had six or seven people that I was supposed to direct. And our job was to sort out classified messages. A lot of them had to do with prisoners of war, all different kinds of prisoners of war. And the task that I did not like is that when you get into intelligence work, you never know what the end is. You know what your job is and you do it, but you never know what happens after that. So I never did know what happened to a lot of the messages that we classified. And it was my job to red stamp those that were supposed to go on to higher echelons. It was also my job every day at 2 o'clock in the afternoon to carry these classified red stamp messages into a locked bag and drive to the Pentagon to deliver them to the Pentagon. That was my job. And it was only 50 miles away, so at 2 o'clock, took me 50 minutes to get there, deliver what I had to do, and then get back to Fort Meade by 4 or 4:30, depending on whether I was held up there. But, I can't even express the feeling that I had the first time I walked into the Pentagon. The thing is just real in my head. Here, at one point, you're an enemy, unfit for military service. And all of a sudden, I'm walking into the Pentagon. And that entrance that I walked into was the very entrance that hijacked plane hit on 911. But anyway, after that, I returned back to Nebraska, finished my degree, which was in pharmacy. And I had no intent to practice pharmacy, so they encouraged me to get my master's degree there in pharmacology and physiology, which I did. And before I knew it, the dean of the school and my mentor had sort of paved the way for me to go to Purdue University to earn my doctorate degree as a full-time instructor. So I was a paid instructor. I was making pretty good money then, but then it took me 4 years and all the summers in between to earn my doctorate. And then I stayed on at Purdue for the better part of 3 decades there, most of it as head of the department that I got my degree in. And then before I knew it, the University of North Carolina came calling. And as a matter of fact, the chancellor of the university flew into Lafayette, Indiana, and he said he wanted to talk with me. And that's how I ended up at the University of North Carolina for an additional 16 years. And there I served as the dean of the School of Pharmacy and as a professor in the School of Medicine. And there they asked me to develop a graduate program in toxicology for joint degree people in medicine, that is MD, PhD students. And That's the group that I was head of. So, but in that whole process, I was very privileged to head up two large organizations. One was the American Association of Colleges of Pharmacy, and the other was the Society of Toxicology, which is international in nature. So I had a lot of exposure to foreign people, but just been it's been a great life for me, and I look at this whole evacuation period. For me, I think it was a blessing because the way everything turned out, I think I must have had an angel perched on my shoulder because she stood me well. So if you have any questions, I'll be glad to take them. Yes?
Where was your two-room schoolhouse?
In Hanford, California. And that school is still standing today and looks exactly what it did when I went to school. It was a Spanish style with red tiles and white stucco. I'm sure the inside was all rejuvenated by now, but it's still standing there.
You've got pictures of it, I hope.
Mm-hmm. And I still remember my teachers. As a matter of fact, the teacher I had from fifth to the eighth grade, I saw her probably two days before she passed away. When I was visiting California, I used to visit her. Mm-hmm. Yes.
How did your parents get from the holding area in California to Arkansas? Did they answer the question no?
They did well, but you know, the main difficulty with the older group was that there was nothing to do. So my dad went out into the swamps and dug up tree roots that he cut up and skinned them and polished them to make little desk ornaments or paperweights from wood. That's what he did. So, but anyway, you know, speaking about my dad, at the time that the FBI swept and took the pool hall operator and the shoe repair guy, I remember my dad saying, he was joking, of course. He said, "I wonder why they didn't take me, because I have more influence than those two guys put together." But it's too bad he didn't live to see it, because about 25 years after his death, the town of Hanford was growing, and they built a new subdivision, and they were looking for someone to name a street after that had made significant contributions to the development of the community of Hanford. And guess who they picked? Yeah. So if you go through Hanford, you'll probably find a street there somewhere. It's there forever.
Did you ever manage to get over the anger? And how did you manage to get over the anger?
No, I can't say that I really had any anger over the process, because the only thing that angered me was that questionnaire I was telling you about. I still remember it, and I don't think I'll ever forgive anybody for that one question. But And the reason why I have no anger is because everything worked out so well for me, personally. And I can't vouch that for, you know, anyone else. But for me, it just worked out beautifully. And I owe all of what I have been to this state and to this university. Yeah. But no, I have no anger whatsoever.
So what lessons from the 1940s should we be aware of in the 21st century? Are there lessons from this period we should think about?
Well, I think, you know, things have changed so much from 1940 to the current. And I don't think what happened in the 40s could really happen today because of all the communication systems that we have now. The social communication systems that and because all through my life after that evacuation period, I've talked to many people all the way across country, and except for people in California who actually experienced it, people outside of California didn't even know it happened. Even today, there are many people who say, oh, did that actually happen? They're not aware that that happened. So I think today, I don't think it could happen because you know how quickly, if you've been following the elections, you see how quickly things change. and people speak over their social communication system. They think it's pretty private, and before you know it, it's, everybody knows what they said.
Did you receive reparations?
Yes. As a matter of fact, if you want to see this, we just passed this around. This is a... You just passed around. This is a letter of apology signed by George Bush. And together with that letter of apology, a check for $20,000. But it came at a time where I didn't really need it because I was within 2 years of retirement. So the check went to the University of Nebraska Foundation. Mm-hmm.
What happened to your brothers and sisters?
Both of my sisters married very well, and both of my sisters are now passed. My two younger brothers also served in the military, one in the Pacific and one in Europe, but they both reverted back to the farm. They both have college degrees, and they parlayed. See, several years before the evacuation period, my dad had accumulated enough money to buy land, but he couldn't buy it. He couldn't purchase it. He was not allowed to purchase land. So he purchased 40 acres in the name of my two older brothers. So that's what they had to return to. And now the nephews are running the farm, and that 40 acres has been parlayed into some 1,000 acres that they're farming in California. They're doing very well. And one of my nephews is really a big gun in the Farm Bureau in California. And to give you some idea how well they're doing on the farm, his house is almost as big as this building. He's got a big swimming pool, big tennis court, and he's got a private plane. So they're doing very well.
I was just curious about your first trip into the Pentagon. I mean, was anyone surprised to see a Japanese person walking into the Pentagon?
No, not really. You know, this is a kind of a funny story, because the first time I walked into the Pentagon, I saw a rush of people coming down the corridor, you know, and I thought, gosh, they're evacuating the Pentagon. But they were all laughing and so forth. And I stopped one of the gals in that big crowd. I says, what's going on? He says, this is our coffee break. No one noticed me.
I want to say thank you to Dr. Tom Mia for sharing his memories with us today. Please join me in thanking Dr. Mia for being here with us. Thank you. In Federalist Paper number 10, James Madison tells us that it is the obligation of the majority to protect the rights of the minority. As citizens, we need to heed Dr. Mia's experience in order to pass this important lesson along to our families, our co-workers, and our friends, and perhaps most importantly, we need to share Dr. Mia's life story with our children and with their children. As Madison inferred, the shining light that is our Constitution can perhaps best be seen when it is used to protect the rights of those who are unable to protect their own rights. With that, we conclude our presentation today.
You've been listening to a lecture program from Bellevue University on Noon Forum. We've heard a talk by Tom Mia, a Japanese-American who, as a result of President Roosevelt's Executive Order 9066, was relocated from his home in California following the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor on December 7, 1941. This program, presented as a celebration of Constitution Day, was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Thursday afternoon, September 15, 2016, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Rick Galusha, Associate Professor in the College of Arts and Sciences at Bellevue University, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of over 600 previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.